Hello, and welcome to This is True Crime, y'all. A true crime podcast from Austin, Texas, made by a lover of true crime such as yourself. Today's subject is Rodney James Alcala. You may know him as the Dating Game Killer. He is a convicted rapist and serial killer who was sentenced to death in California in 2010 for 5 murders committed between 1977 and 1979. He's thought to be responsible for many others, with numbers to rival even the most prolific of serial murderers. He operated around the same time as Ted Bundy, the Son of Sam, and the Hillside Strangler, and some of his crimes were attributed to these other serial killers until DNA and other evidence came to light. Rodney James Alcala was born August 23, 1943. He was born Rodrigo Jaquez Alcala Bucur in San Antonio, Texas, to Raul Alcala Bucur and Anna Marie Gutierrez. He and his sisters were raised by his mother in suburban Los Angeles after his father abandoned the family. Not much more is known about his childhood or his teenage years until he joins the United States Army in 1960, where he served as a clerk. In 1964, after what was described as a nervous breakdown, he was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder by a military psychiatrist. And this is where the accounts are going to differ. In one account, it says that he was then immediately discharged on medical grounds by a military psychiatrist. I don't believe this to be the case. I believe this is something he made up to make himself sound better, because I have found many other sources, including military records, that show that he was discharged after going AWOL. While assigned to Fort Campbell on the Kentucky-Tennessee border, Private First Class Rodney Alcala went AWOL multiple times. In June 1963, he took a routine pass to Nashville, Tennessee. According to an Army report, after stealing a car and robbing another driver of their credit card, he fled to New York City. One night after leaving a bar in New York, he saw a young lady walking down the street. He followed her a short distance and struck her with a Coke bottle. Luckily, she was able to escape. Alcala then traveled to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where he was arrested and charged by military police authorities with being absent without leave. While he was being transported with a military escort back to Fort Campbell, he was able to escape as they changed trains in Atlanta, Georgia, and ran to his family's home in California. Alcala's mothers and sisters advised him to turn himself in. While staying there on the run, it's said that he exposed himself to his younger sister, who, quote, became hysterical, the report said. Private Alcala stated that he did not know if he wanted to have sexual relations with her. What the fuck? Experts with the Army Hospital in Fort Ord, California, determined Alcala knew right from wrong, but he is totally unsuitable for further military duty. He pled guilty to the charges and paid a fine. His rank was reduced, but he was discharged honorably, without a blemish on his record. Alcala, who claims to have a genius-level IQ, never tested, by the way, later graduated from the UCLA School of Fine Arts after his discharge. He later attended New York University using the alias John Berger, where he studied film under Roman Polanski. On September 25, 1969, second grader Talee Shapiro was walking to school alongside Hollywood Sunset Boulevard when a car pulled up alongside of her. the driver, 25-year-old shitbag UCLA fine arts student Rodney Alcala, asked her if she wanted a ride. She told him, flat out, I don't talk to strangers. That's when he told me he knew my parents. I really didn't want to get into the car, but I was raised to respect my elders. I didn't know I should fear people. The suspicious event raised the concern of a Good Samaritan who saw Talee climbing into the vehicle with the shaggy-haired young man. This person followed Alcala as he drove to his nearby apartment and then called the police. I don't remember going up to the apartment, Shapiro said, and I don't remember anything after that. Thank goodness. Former Los Angeles police officer Chris Camacho was driving toward West Hollywood when he learned what happened and followed the Good Samaritan to the kidnapper's apartment. Camacho called in a request for backup unit. He went to the front door and started knocking. I could hear someone running around, he says. The man answered the door and claimed he had just been in the shower. I see this male person on the other side, no clothes, not dripping with water, no towel. I said, okay, you need to open the door right now. I need to come in. Alcala says, wait, let me put my pants on. I said, okay, you got 3 seconds. At the time, police didn't know they would soon let a budding serial killer slip through their grasp. The door was shut again, but after waiting a few moments, Camacho bashed in the door. He looked to his right and saw a dining room, and to the left was a living room. Straight ahead was a kitchen, and here was this little girl. She was nude, covered in blood, and there was a metal bar pressed against her neck. Her tiny Mary Jane shoes were strewn about the floor. I looked at her. I thought she was dead. She wasn't breathing, Camacho said. The other officers came around. We were looking for the suspect, but I went back to check on her. I just couldn't leave her there like that. Camacho was faced with a very difficult decision: chase the suspect out the back or render life-saving aid to this little girl. Thankfully, he chose to stay with her. As I went back in the kitchen, she started gagging, so that put everything into high gear. We later found out the suspect had escaped through the back door. Miraculously, Shapiro survives this brutal attack. She was in a coma for 32 days, but was able to get back on her feet after months in the hospital. In the apartment, the police discover a UCLA student ID card with Alcala's name. They also find hundreds, if not thousands, of sexually explicit photos of young women and boys. Some of the photos are innocent beach and public photos of women and children of varying ages, but some were definitely of murdered and posed victims. The women in the photos range in age from schoolgirls to women in their 20s and 30s and are believed to come from across the U.S. Prosecutor Matt Murphy would later say, we'd like to locate the women in these pictures. Did they simply pose for a serial killer, or did they become victims of his sadistic, murderous pattern? Detective Clave Shepard would say, he's right up there, somewhere below Hitler and right around Ted Bundy. It is not humane what he did to these victims. It is torturous. After Shapiro recovered, her family moved to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and stayed there for many years. This is when he fled to the East Coast and enrolled in the NYU Film School. During the summer months, he was counseling children at a New Hampshire arts camp, using a slightly different alias of John Berger. The first one, B-E-R-G-E-R, the second, like hamburger. It's there that he murdered once again and would remain a fugitive for many years. In New York City in 1971, he would eventually murder Cornelia Crilly. Crilly grew up in Queens, New York. At 23, she had achieved her dream of becoming a TWA stewardess and lived in an apartment with several of her stewardess friends on East 83rd Street in Manhattan. On June 24, 1971, Crilly's boyfriend, Leon Bornstein, received a call from her mother, in which he said she hadn't heard from her daughter. Bornstein offered to check Crilly's apartment. She was living in a building where I could go into the building without a key. I knocked on the door and there was no response. That's when I called the cops. I was at the front door when they broke into the back window. They opened the door and told me that she had been murdered. Crilly was found on the floor of her apartment, strangled with nylon stockings, and had bite marks on her breast. She had been raped and brutally murdered. In 1971, two former campers of Alcala's noticed an FBI wanted poster at the local post office and notified camp directors. He was immediately arrested and extradited back to California. By then, Tally Shapiro's parents had relocated to Mexico and refused to allow her to testify. Unable to convict him of rape and attempted murder without their primary witness, prosecutors were forced to permit Alcala to plead guilty to a lesser charge. He was paroled after only 34 months in 1974 under the Indeterminate Sentencing Program, popular at the time. This program allowed parole boards to release offenders as soon as they had demonstrated evidence of rehabilitation. You cannot rehabilitate these fucking monsters. And to prove that point, less than 2 months later, he was arrested for violating parole and providing marijuana to a 13-year-old girl who he tried to kidnap. Once again, he was paroled after serving only 2 years of a, quote, indeterminate sentence. I really wish indeterminate meant until you fucking die. As soon as he was out, he was back to roaming New York City streets, hoping to photograph any passerby who agreed. Eventually, he approached nightclub heiress Ellen Hover, and the two started talking. Ellen was strikingly beautiful. She had long dark hair, long slender arms and legs, and carried herself like a dancer. She was very trusting of other people. She came from a Hollywood family, grew up in Beverly Hills, and then New York, and then Manhattan. Ellen loved people. Hover's father was the owner of Ciro's in Hollywood, a well-known nightclub where such people as Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, and other celebrities frequently appeared. She was reported missing on July 15, 1977, one day after the city's infamous blackout when looting and violence was rampant in the streets. Feinberg said she got a call from Hoover's mother in which she asked if Feinberg had heard from her. The next thing I knew, I was watching the 11 o'clock news, and there was Ellen's picture, along with the headline, New York Heiress Missing. While police searched Hover's apartment, they found a calendar with a July 15th entry that read, John Berger. Knowing he was in deep shit, he fled back to Los Angeles. And by this point, the FBI knew the name John Berger as his alias from when he was caught in New Hampshire and tracked him down. Upon questioning, he did admit to meeting her, but they had not yet found her body and determined there was no evidence to arrest him. 11 months after she went missing, her skeletal remains were found 30 miles north of the city in Tarrytown, New York. She was only able to be identified through dental comparison, and there was no forensic evidence at the scene that pointed to her killer. Later that year in 1977, Despite his criminal record and official registration as a sex offender, he was hired as a typesetter by the Los Angeles Times. In the midst of their coverage of the Hillside Strangler, he must have felt right at home. He committed 4 more murders in Los Angeles, California, between 1977 and 1979. Their cases were cold until 2003, when DNA technology helped connect them to Alcala. He didn't want to give his DNA, and it's really no wonder why. The bodies of Jill Barcombe, Georgia Wickstead, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parenteau were all discovered brutally murdered and sexually assaulted. November 10, 1977. Jill Barcombe, only 18 years old, of Oneida, New York, had been in Southern California for about 3 weeks when her body was found on a dirt path on Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles. She was in a kneaded chest position and naked from the waist down. She had been strangled with a pair of blue jeans and beaten. There were signs of rape as well. She also had 3 bite marks on her right breast, according to the LA County Coroner's Office. December 16, 1977. Georgia Wickstead, 27, was found dead in her Malibu home, naked, battered, and sexually assaulted. A hammer was found next to her body, and she was believed to be sexually assaulted with that weapon as well. She was a nurse at Centinella Hospital and was born in New York. 2 types of blood were found in her apartment, and Alcala was linked to them, as we said, with his DNA. On June 24, 1978, Charlotte Lamb of Santa Monica, 32 years old, was found naked and dead in a laundry room of a large apartment complex in El Segundo. She had no known ties to this apartment complex and made it that much more perplexing for police. Lamb, a legal secretary, had been sexually assaulted and strangled with a shoelace. The apartment manager found her body, but residents said they had never seen her before. June 14, 1979, Jill Parenteau, a 21-year-old computer program operator, was killed after an intruder broke into her Burbank home by jimmying the windows. Her nude body was found on the floor, propped up by pillows. Jill Barcombe's death was originally attributed to the work of the Hillside Strangler. In a strange coincidence, Barcombe's friend, 15-year-old Judith Lynn Miller, was abducted and murdered by the Hillside Strangler 1 month later. Her brother Bruce said he had night terrors when his sister's body was discovered. "It wasn't just murder," he said. "It was rape. It was brutal. It was sadistic, and no one could understand why these things happened to her." Then, in a weird-ass twist, in 1978, after he had murdered at least 5 women across 2 coasts and had been charged with the attempted murder of an 8-year-old girl, instead of laying low, he made his primetime debut on The Dating Game. The Dating Game was a TV show that involved one contestant asking questions to 3 potential suitors hidden from view and using their answers to choose one at the end. Background checks were not performed, or they would have known that he had a violent criminal history. The contestant coordinator, Ellen Metzger, thought he was striking at the time. Her future husband, the show's executive producer, disagreed. "In terms of putting him on as a contestant, I think on the form I wrote N/W, which stood for no way, because I noticed that he had a very strange personality. Eventually I said, all right, we'll put him on a show, but we've got to surround him with 2 guys that have personalities and are respectable and decent and fun." Alcala was given the position of Bachelor No. 1. Jed Mills sat next to him as Bachelor No. 2. He was a little creepy. I noticed that right away, Mills later told 2020. In the green room, he jumps in and says, I always get my girl. And I immediately did not like this guy. While on the show, Alcala made playful innuendos to The Bachelorette. The show's producers acknowledge, in hindsight, the comments are chilling. Bradshaw ultimately chooses Alcala of the three contestants to go on a date with, but the next day she reconsidered her decision. She called Ellen Metzger. She said, Ellen, I can't go out with this guy. There's like weird vibes that are coming off of him. He's very strange, and I am not comfortable. Is that going to be a problem? And of course I said no. His encounter with Robin Samso in June of 1979 would eventually be the thing that brought Alcala down. 17-year-old Lori Wirtz was spending her afternoon roller skating with her friend Patty at Sunset Beach. She was approached by Alcala. He told them he's a photographer and offered to take their photos. Lori immediately agreed. But he was asking me all kinds of questions, like where I'm from, my name, my age. He tried really hard to get me in the car. He tried to get me in the car and leave my friends on the beach. She refused when she saw him driving towards Huntington Beach, where 12-year-old Robin Samso was enjoying the day. She was the youngest of four in her family. She always had a spirit about her, Taran Mays, Robin's older sister, said. I mean, everybody that met her fell in love with her. On June 20th, 1979, Robin was with her friend, Bridget Wilvert, when Alcala approached them for pictures. Wilvert refused, and one of the adults chased him off. Later in the day, Robin was running late to her job at a ballet studio. Wilvert told her to use her bike and remembered telling her not to stop. Later that evening, Wilvert received a call from one of Robin's brothers asking if she was still with her. She learned then that she never showed up to ballet. Robin's mother called the police shortly after. That was my mom's baby, Mays said. My mom cried every single day. Wilvert worked with a sketch artist to create a composite of the man they had talked to on the beach. The sketch was broadcast on TV, and Alcala's parole officers recognized him, along with the Good Samaritan who followed Alcala's car when he lured Tali Shapiro into it and attacked her all those years before. 12 days after Robin's disappearance, a park ranger in the Sierra Madres found human remains that had been scavenged by animals. The dental records matched those of Robin. I remember I was laying on the couch and the doorbell rang and I answered the door. It was the police, Mays remembers. They came in and told us they had found Robin, and my mom broke down, as well as everybody else, my brothers, myself, the whole family. It was truly devastating. She says her mother will never be the same. It's just like her life just had this big empty hole, and everyone else was on the outside, just looking in, unable to do anything for her pain. On July 24th, 1979, Alcala was arrested at his mother's house in Monterey Park, California, and charged with Robin's murder. While there, the investigators found a receipt for a self-storage facility outside of Seattle. In their investigation of the storage locker, this is when they uncovered the treasure trove of evidence. Thousands of pictures of people, young, old, nude, in compromised positions. There were a variety of pieces of jewelry, which investigators believe he took as trophies from his victims. I remember them asking my mom to come and identify some things that they found in that locker. They had found gold ball earrings, which matched the ones Robin wore when she disappeared. Now we're going to get to his long and arduous journey through the criminal justice system. He was eventually convicted of murder 3 times in the same case. Unfortunately, it had been overturned, which sounds just like Robert Craig Cox. But, you know, I digress. So in 1980, he was tried for Robin Samso's murder. The jury convicted him and sentenced him to death. He was taken to San Quentin State Prison, where he was put on death row. 4 years later, he appealed and won. The verdict was overturned after the California Supreme Court determined the jurors in his trial had been improperly informed of his prior sexual crimes and could have been biased against him based on those facts. In 1986, he got a new trial, 7 years after Robin was murdered. A second jury convicted him and recommended once again he be sentenced to death. In 2001, he appealed again and got his death penalty overturned. Again. Because it was determined that his attorney in the second trial had not put forth a strong enough defense. In 2003, former Orange County prosecutor and ABC News contributor Matt Murphy was assigned to the case. By then, there had been significant advancements in DNA technology. So he had the jewelry found in the Seattle storage unit re-examined. The DNA evidence returned matches to Charlotte Lamb, Jill Parenteau, Georgia Wixted, and Jill Barcombe. Alcala, by now 66 years old, represented himself in his third trial in 2010. For a third time, he was convicted and sentenced to death. Additional evidence, including other cold case DNA matches, led to his indictment for the murders of the 4 other women. In 2003, prosecutors entered a motion to join the Samso charges with those of the 4 newly discovered victims. Of course, he contested the motion. In 2006, the California Supreme Court ruled in the prosecution's favor. At this third trial, he acted as his own attorney and told jurors, often in a rambling monotone, that he was at Knott's Berry Farm when she was kidnapped. He offered no other defense of any kind in the other 4 cases. During his closing arguments, he asked jurors to spare him from the death penalty, saying they would become killers themselves if they sent him to death row, and arguing that the sentence would lead to decades of appeals. You're asking for clemency from the death penalty when you have literally murdered tons of women. The fucking gall. He was quoted as saying, "A sentence of life in prison without parole would end this matter right now." In part of his closing argument, he played the portion of Arlo Guthrie's song, Alice's Restaurant, in which the protagonist tells a psychiatrist that he wants to kill. He was convicted on all 5 counts. A surprise witness during the penalty phase of the trial was Tali Shapiro, Alcala's first known victim. In March 2010, he was sentenced to death for a third time. Hopefully that one sticks. The state of California placed a moratorium on the death penalty in 2019, meaning all prisoners on death row received a stay of execution. Robin Samso's mother died July 2019 and never got to see him executed. She wanted to see the day that Alcala leaves this earth and that he does not breathe anymore. It's unfair. It's just unfair. Someone so cruel and evil gets to still live and breathe. Over the years, Alcala was given multiple opportunities to disclose information about any additional victims. They wanted to plead with him, "We can let you avoid the death penalty." but like an asshat that he is, he continuously refused to provide any information. In 2013, he did plead guilty to killing Crilly and Hover in New York and was sentenced to 25 years to life, the highest sentence possible there. He is believed to have murdered many other women based on the photos that they've found and released and are hoping to help families find missing loved ones. Authorities believe they found answers in another case 40 years later that will be linked to him. This is the case of Christine Thornton's disappearance. Like many other jurisdictions across the country, investigators in Sweetwater County, Wyoming, are assigned cold cases every few years in hopes that fresh eyes or technological advances can finally solve them. In 2013, Sheriff's Deputy Jeff Shaman was assigned to a 1977 cold case, and the box of evidence was just falling apart. In the summer of 77, Chris, who was just 27 years old, was pregnant at the time. She met up with her boyfriend and had this crazy idea of going to Montana to pan for gold. At the time, Chrissy Thornton and her boyfriend were living in San Antonio and decided to take the road trip up north. While the couple was in southwest Wyoming, they had a fight and went separate ways. That was the last time Chris Thornton was seen alive. Kathy Thornton went to San Antonio to find her sister's boyfriend, but to no avail. She said the San Antonio police refused to take a missing persons report because her sister was an adult and could disappear if she wanted to. In 1982, 5 years after Chris Thornton went missing, a herder in Granger, Wyoming, came across human bones. Investigators found it was the remains of a 25 to 35-year-old woman alongside the bones of an unborn child. The autopsy showed the remains had been laid out since around 1977. The authorities weren't able to identify her at the time, and the case went cold. Decades later, upon taking on the case, Shaman called the Wyoming State Lab and learned they still had the remains found by the rancher. He requested a DNA sample to see if there would be any matches with missing persons through CODIS. That same year, Kathy Thornton received an email from her son in which he said he'd read an article containing photos that were found in Alcala's storage unit. As she looked through the photos, Kathy Thornton stopped on a beautiful brunette seated on the back of a motorcycle. She believes it is her long-lost sister. I looked at her pinky toe, which I remember. It was just very distinctive. It curled up on her other toes, she said, and I knew that was her. That was definitely my sister. Kathy Thornton submitted her DNA to a national database. In 2015, there was a match, and they were finally able to identify Chris Thornton's remains. From there, the officer working the case, along with HBPD, was able to put together a timeline of Alcala's movements the summer of 1977. Fresh out of prison, he had just been given permission to travel to New York. He drove across the country from Los Angeles to New York. The investigators believe Alcala and Thornton met by chance in Wyoming as he was making his cross-country trek. There's no rhyme or reason to how these two people, one so good and one so evil, crossed paths to end up there, Kathy Thornton said. In September 2016, Alcala was charged with first-degree murder in Wyoming for Thornton's murder. By then, he was 73 years old and confined to a bed at Corcoran State Prison in California. When Shaman confronted him with the photo of Thornton on the motorcycle, he would only admit to taking the photo and nothing more. Due to his failing health, authorities decide not to extradite him to Wyoming to stand trial. The charges have not been dropped, but he has not entered a plea. It was disappointing that we weren't going to get a conviction on her murder, her sister said. But the good thing about all of this is that this man has been brought to light as being a serial killer. Rodney James Alcala, convicted murderer, rapist, and all-around garbage human being, eventually died in custody of natural causes on July 24th, 2021, while awaiting his execution. He wrote a book while he was in prison in 1994 called You, the Jury, where he proclaimed his innocence. Now, although this does sound like the conclusion of this case, because he can't go on hurting women any longer, there are other victims out there. Obviously, I firmly believe that some of those women in those pictures are no longer with us. And then, out of the blue, out of nowhere, I have just discovered this. I mean, I've been doing research for a while. He has been on my list, you know, forever. But I just found a story of a woman who says that she was probably his first rape victim. I'm going to read her story verbatim as she tells it in her own words. This is very graphic, and I want to give a warning. These are her words. I will not take any liberties or diverge from her script. This is called In My Own Words by Morgan Rowan. I was 16 when he raped me. He had hurt me earlier when I was 13 or 14. He also successfully attacked my friend when she was 15 on our front lawn in broad daylight. He managed to get her pants off, but her brother chased him away. Her parents wrote it off to a teenage prank. He would have been 24 years old at the time, the dark side of the 60s. I share this story today as a wake-up call to listen to your instincts. I write this here to share with your daughters and granddaughters, not in this graphic detail, but paraphrased in your own style about the dangers of ignoring your own instincts, bowing to peer pressure, and not sharing important events with your parents or loved ones. I write this to never forget the lessons learned. But mostly, I write this to remind you that we all carry our scars and our history. Be good to each other. This was my brush with a serial killer. Let me warn you, it's violent and graphic. Feel free to skip it. When I was 13, maybe 14, and more immature than most, I started hanging out in Hollywood with a wild child friend of mine. I looked more like a 10-year-old, and I was so small I still bought my clothes in the children's department. My girlfriend Evie were out in front of a teen nightclub in the late afternoon. It was still bright and sunshiny, and the famous Hullabaloo Club was not open yet. Evie wandered off with some schoolmates she happened upon, and that left me alone with two guys much older than me, talking to each other in the parking lot of the club. I knew one of them. A friend of mine had a bit of a crush on him. He was rakishly handsome, bright white smile and thick wavy hair. He stood strong and confident, with dark piercing eyes. His name was Rod. I didn't know it at the time, but he was far from a boy. I wanted his attention, of course. I was a kid. So I went up to this older boy and scratched his arm playfully with my fingernails. He laughed, hugged me, and went on with his conversation. I loved that attention, of course. So I continued to run up and scratch his arm lightly until his laughter dissolved and he became annoyed. He stopped his conversation and said bluntly, "If you don't stop that, I'm going to take you out back and rape you." A moment of awkward silence, and then we all three laughed at the ridiculousness of what he had just said. But being so young, this was big-time adult stuff, and it was game on. I continued to run up and scratch his arm. His friend said goodbye and walked off. As soon as his friend walked away, Rod roughly grabbed my arm and forced all 80 pounds of me, shocked and protesting, to the deserted back-loading dock area of the club. I remember his changed and angry face and how terrifying that was. I remember the pain of his grip and how my feet barely got a chance to touch the ground. I remember nothing more until I woke up with a massive headache pinned behind an industrial dumpster. I was fully clothed, my mouth was bleeding, and I had a huge lump on my heavily bleeding head. After pushing off the heavy dumpster, pinning me to the wall, and cautiously assuring myself that Rod was no longer there, I ran to the owner of the now-open club and spilled my story. His wife took me into the bathroom, gently asked some frightening questions, and told me I hadn't been raped, then cleaned me up and assured me that Rod would be banned from the club for life. No police were called. I didn't want them to. I never told my parents in fear I wouldn't be allowed to go back there again. A swollen cut lip was all that showed, but I carried the bruise of his fingerprints on my arm and the huge knot on my head, hidden for weeks. I figured, lesson learned, don't tease boys. I only caught glimpses of Rod over the next few years and always steered clear and immediately left the area. He scared me, of course, but everyone else was quite comfortable around his good looks and charm, and they liked him. One more warning on what is to come. My purpose is not to upset anyone. A few years later, I was 16 and leaving California to move to New York with my family in 5 days. I was spending my last few nights with my friends up on Sunset Strip when Rod, now maybe 26, appeared in the crowd and kept following me, saying he was sorry, had been a stupid kid, and didn't want me to leave hating him, etc. I eventually accepted his apology just to get rid of him and went my own separate way. But there was no way I was leaving this area this night. I only had 5 more nights in California. Rod disappeared into the crowd and I forgot all about him. I was much more upset about saying goodbye to my friends and the Hollywood nights that I loved. Much later, someone said, "Come on, we're going to IHOP," and we all jumped happily into a car. I was in the back, wedged between 2 friends, and the driver jumped in and started the car. It was Rod. Too late to get out as the car moved into traffic, and my friends were not sympathetic to my fears. "Come on," he said, "he was sorry. It was long ago. Nothing really happened," they reasoned. So I was stuck. Rod constantly looked in the rearview mirror with a strange half-smile on his face, and I felt chills run up and down my spine. We went to IHOP and sat across from each other, too close for comfort at the table. But I was surrounded by my friends, so it was bearable. I ignored my cold sweat, shaking hands, and managed to keep my head down and eat a few bites. Rod seemed, thankfully, to not pay much attention to me there, and I convinced myself that the creepy stares in the car were just part of my imagination. After excusing myself to the restroom, I stood staring at the payphone with a coin in my shaking hand, wanting to call my father. But I put the dime back into my pocket and resisted the urge because I only had a few nights left with my friends. That unused dime and those seconds would soon change my life. As we got back into the car and headed back to the strip, I was feeling more calm and happy to be done with this and anxious to be out of his car. Then suddenly, Rod turned a corner and drove to a house on De Long Pre Avenue, a block or so off of Sunset. It turned out to be his house. He said to my friends in the car, "Come in, I've got pot," and they all went happily into his house. There was already a bit of a party going on with some people before we got there. I sat shivering outside, hoping it wouldn't be long, and my friend Mike came out and said, Are you really any safer sitting out here alone in the dark? So I went in. Loud music, a bunch of people, lots of commotion. Pop party. I stayed standing, shifting, and pacing because I just wanted to leave. After we had been there a while, Rod suddenly appeared, grabbed my arm, and pulled me to a door not far from where I had been standing, his too tight grip bruising my arm once again. He picked a moment that my friends didn't see. It happened in the blink of an eye. He threw me headfirst into the room, and as I staggered to my feet and turned back towards him, I could see that on the back of his bedroom door was a metal bar that dropped down to secure the entire door, beyond what anyone would ever need for privacy. I knew with a sinking heart that I was in ugly trouble. He outweighed me by 80 or more pounds. He came toward me while reaching for the leather belt on his pants, and I started to back away and plead and beg. I couldn't seem to find the air in my lungs to scream. I doubt anyone would have heard me anyway. I still believed he would listen to reason if I could just find the right words, as I backed up far enough that I could go no further. My back now against the wall, my arms were in front of me, like I could somehow hold him away from me. He stopped just a few steps from me, and without a word, he braced his stance and punched me straight between my eyes. I felt my head jerk and slam against the wall with the recoil of his fist, and I saw stars and tasted blood and fell to my knees in shock, holding my swimming head. I had most certainly never been punched before. He wrapped my long hair around his wrist, leaving me helpless, and tied my hands behind my back with my own scarf while the room still spun around me. I fought back, but his hold on my hair, wrapped tight around his left wrist, kept me where he wanted, doubled over on my knees. With my hands now bound, he folded his leather belt and stuffed it deep into my mouth, so deep that I couldn't breathe. I kicked and fought for breath, so he lifted me by my hair and punched me hard in the stomach a few times to quiet me. I felt the sickening pops of my own ribs breaking. Blood and bile surged into my mouth, and I began to choke and drown in fluids, with the belt wedged tightly deep in my mouth. I was certain I was going to die, and alternated between fighting to breathe as my lungs filled with blood and accepting my fate and praying to God to take me quick as the room blurred and spun. I was a virgin. It wasn't easy for him. I still had some fight in me. This angered him more. He punched me repeatedly against my broken ribs to stop me from fighting. A searing pain and a flash of silver as my jeans were cut off of me. The pain from being punched and the terror of fighting for air eclipsed every other pain and violation of the rape I suffered that night. But his angry face so close to mine and his hot breath and burning eyes so full of hate and evil scorched into my nightmares for a lifetime. A lifetime I was then sure I would never have. My friends were so close that without a wall and a barricaded door, I could have thrown something and hit them. The loud music masked everything from their side. I believe he would have killed me there, witnesses in the next room and all. He had crossed a line outside of reality, and he was of a violent, single focus, and he was just so violently angry, his face was bright crimson. It just wasn't enough to satisfy him, and his hands now tightened around my neck as his rage took over. Evie noticed I was missing and instinctively knew I didn't go willingly. I was in trouble. Someone pointed out his room. My friends began to yell and pound on the door. He ignored them, swearing and muttering to himself in anger. Then the voices and pounding stopped, and in all that silence, a terrible weight of abandonment seemed to press me further under his weight and into the wooden floor. My glimmer of hope drifting away with my breath like sand through an hourglass, and I fell very still and resigned myself to my fate. I felt nothing more of his violation, and I was no longer fighting. I was drifting now, somewhere far away, falling into an endless, dark void. Then, glass breaking and voices shouting, I was startled back into the light. Mike had broken through the window to his room. Rod got off of me and then stood up and opened the bolted door. I was frozen in time. My reality was gone. I didn't even try to move. I just choked and gasped on the hard wooden floor. Mike and Evie ran into his room and stopped frozen in total shock. In front of my speechless friends, Rod stood there naked from the waist down with my blood all over his shirt and spat out, "Take her." Just like that. Like he owned me. Take her. Mike ran to my side, pulled out the horrible, suffocating belt, and lifted me, gasping and choking, to my feet. On my wobbly feet now, air burning into my lungs, I ran frantic from that nightmare house, wearing just a ripped and bloody blouse. Mike caught up with me and hid me in an alley a block from Rod's house, and Evie was not far behind. The three of us hid in the alley for fear of being followed. Finding myself behind a dumpster again was no small irony. Mike covered me with his shirt and tried to quiet my violent shaking as Evie worked on untying the knotted, bloody scarf holding my wrists. I was throwing up blood and choking and still felt like I might die there, half naked, doubled over in that cold and dirty place. We were just down the street from his house. He must have regretted his decision to let me go and got into his car and drove slowly around the area, his headlights appearing like ghosts skimming across the walls of the alley again and again. Each time the lights appeared, Evie put her hand over my mouth to mask the sound of my choking, and raw terror washed over me once again. There was nowhere I could imagine to feel safe. I felt frozen to my core, violently shivering so hard I chipped teeth, and wondered if I would ever feel safe again. Eventually, Rod gave up looking, parked, and went back into his house, and I literally walked in front of a stranger's moving car, battered, bleeding, and half naked, and begged the people to take us away from there. Things were so different in the 60s, it was often framed to be the victim's fault. The police officer I talked to curled up into a ball on the couch in Evie's borrowed clothes and wrapped shivering in a blanket had little sympathy for what appeared to him to be a tug of war between a couple of hippie freaks. He could see the black eyes forming, the torn lips, but he could not see anything else, nor did he seem to care to ask about injuries that he could not see. He didn't even try to call my parents. He made me feel more dirty and wretched than I already had. I chose not to seek charges because, one, the officer saw me as a little hippie girl in the days of free love, and obviously, no one official seemed to care. Two, he said it wasn't a crime because I had gone willingly, kind of, into the house. And three, my father had been transferred, and we were leaving California in 5 days. My family would only be torn apart by court proceedings on the opposite coast, and for what, I felt they would never convict him. The officer never even asked his name. I'm sorry to Oh, God, fuck. Okay. Whew, okay. There was no DNA and just his word against mine. I just wanted to feel safe again. I was not capable of thinking beyond my fear. Mike was still trying to wrap his mind around what had happened in that house. He was overwhelmed with feelings of guilt for bringing me into the house and determined now to protect me. I just couldn't face my parents. I vowed to never bring this pain upon them. I was afraid I couldn't bear the pain in their eyes. I had done this to myself, and I would not drag them to hell with me, for hell is most certainly where I was now. Mike took me to his tiny apartment on Venice Beach. His neighbor, a nurse, wrapped my broken ribs with tape and helped me clear my lungs of blood. They encouraged me to go to the ER, but you have to want to live to go there, and I wasn't sure I had that in me yet. Mike never left my side. He was careful not to startle me and was very gentle when he touched me. That first night was just a blur of pain and confusion. I just wanted to escape and sleep, but my mind wouldn't rest. Mike bundled me in warm blankets, and we sat on the beach waiting for the sun to rise over the ocean on a day I didn't want to see come. He rocked me like a baby each night in his arms, while I shook violently from fear and pain from my broken ribs. Nights were the worst. Darkness seemed to swallow me. I could see the stars over the ocean through his window as I laid in Mike's arms, with his tears falling softly on my face. And I prayed each night to just go to live on. I don't remember even speaking for all of those days. He bathed my wounds, tried to feed me, and rocked me to sleep when I could. We just held each other and cried. Mike truly saved my life. When we could wait no longer, he took me home, and I told my parents, as we were about to leave California, that the visible black eye and bruises were from a car that stopped short. No seat belts then, and in the confusion of the move, they believed me. A scarf covered the blue fingerprints on my neck, and it took sheer willpower and tears to tie it around my neck each day. We drove 6 long days across the country with my ribs secretly taped and in pain with every bump in the road. I had my own motel room each night and never once used the bed. I cowered in the corner of my room, hugging myself and shaking all night. I felt no one could grab me from behind with my back to a corner. I could still feel Rod's hot breath on my skin. I could still feel his spit and sweat fall onto my face. I could still see the evil that burned red hot in his eyes. I feared he could somehow burst open the door at any moment. I longed for the solace of my own bed and my familiar room, but it was gone. It seemed all my peace was gone now, but I was determined to leave behind this horror and remember instead the beauty of the love generation. I chose to remember Mike's loving touch and not Rod's hateful one. I was in New York a few weeks now, feeling safer with the distance and trying to rebuild my strength and adapt. Evie sent me a letter, and a newspaper clipping fell to the floor. Rod had raped and savagely beat an 8-year-old girl in that very same house. Someone saw him talk to the little girl into his car and followed him to his house and reported it. He had beat her in the head with a lead pipe and raped her right there in the same place just weeks after what he had done to me. My knees buckled. I felt physically sick. I fell to my knees and begged God to forgive me and for that child to forgive me. I had let this happen. A policeman intervened and stopped him from killing the little girl, but in the effort to save her life, Rod got away. Years later, he was caught and sent to prison. I felt safe again. But he served less than 2 years for that awful crime against that child because she was unable to testify. My offered testimony was useless, as there was no evidence. His name wasn't even on a police report. After his release, he stalked young girls and women, telling them he was a photographer and could make them famous. He roamed free for more than 20 years. He is currently on death row in California for 7 murders, but they suspect he has killed more than 100 women and girls. The judge, overwhelmed for the victims, cried in the courtroom as she sentenced him. "It all seems like a book I read or something. It doesn't seem like it happened to me until about 15 years ago, when Rod's face suddenly appeared on the local news, and I had a panic attack so severe I had to go to the hospital for treatment. I guess the reality is still there somewhere, but I think I did a fair job of not letting it control my life. I had kept it to myself for so many years because I didn't want to cause my parents pain. But they were gone now, and it all flooded out with that face on the newscast. I wish I could have stopped him long ago before he hurt anyone else. I never thought at the time about him hurting someone else. I thought his anger was only directed at me. I should have tried harder and found a way to stop him. The guilt over the 8-year-old girl hurt worse than my experience. But I learned over time that I had done all I could with what I had. You either learn and grow from your experiences, or you suffer them for a lifetime, or maybe a little of both. Update. It's been 50 years now, and recently, through the miracle of the internet, the worst of the pain has found a way to heal. A friend connected me to the little 8-year-old girl that I felt so guilty about. Now a grown woman, of course. I wrote her a letter and poured my heart out. I told her how wrong I had been, not to try harder to prosecute him. I told her I should have saved her. I should have done something. I should have gone back to that house and killed the bastard. I asked her to forgive me. She wrote me back words that washed over me like sunshine. The only person responsible for what that man did to us was him, she said. He's pure evil. There is nothing to forgive. We are planning to meet soon. I am overwhelmed by your kindness. Wow, sorry for the crying, but I did have an experience similar to that myself, where I did not pursue charges against someone who later on went to commit crimes against someone else. And I too have felt that guilt of not being able to protect them. But at the time, you have to do whatever you can to survive. So I completely understand. So that is the case of Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer. I want to thank everyone for listening to This is True Crime, y'all. I know that it's a little longer in between episodes than I would like. Unfortunately, I still have a full-time job, and I can only get this done in a small window of time. The research takes quite some time. I want everything to be perfect. I want you to get all the details, and I just want to be your true crime expert. So thank you once again, and if you have any suggestions, please feel free to email me at thisistruecrimeyall@gmail.com. I know there's no apostrophe in y'all. And I know how heinous this sounds, but they would not let me put an apostrophe in that email address. So it is thisistruecrimeyall@gmail.com with no apostrophe. Thank you again for listening. I hope you have a great night, and I look forward to the next one.